The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. It's not raining today, thankfully. This is episode 199 of Colombia Calling, so we're right on the threshold of 200, but 199. And this week's guest I'm very, very excited about because she's a young author, Julianne Pacheco. Her book is The Lucky Ones, available in the US and the UK. In the UK, I believe it's Faber and Faber US. I can't remember exactly, but she'll correct me on this. But we've got her on the line from Medellin, because she's down here visiting, I guess, for a little bit over the summer, before heading back to the University of East Anglia in Norwich, Norfolk, where I actually used to have family around there. But I'm going to give you all a little bit of a background about Julianne, because actually, in a bizarre twist of fate, I know or have met briefly her twin sister, Elisa, who's, again, accomplished and worked for a number of years, I think, for Insight Crime. So, again, a website that we check out and recommend if you want to read about Colombia. But anyway, so Julianne, very accomplished. Her book is set in Colombia between 1993 and 2013, the peak years of violence during the long Colombian conflict. This jigsaw puzzle of a novel centers on a group of wealthy girls, the daughters of expats and local elite, and the teachers, housekeepers, warlords, and guerrilla fighters who surround them. It's a prismatic tale of a group of characters who emerge and recede throughout the novel and touch one another's lives in ways they cannot comprehend. The Lucky Ones captures the intensity of life in Colombia as paramilitaries, guerrillas, and drug traffickers tear the country apart. Combining vivid descriptions of life under siege with hallucinatory feel that befits its world, The Lucky Ones introduces a truly original and exciting new voice in fiction. I mean, that is a pretty great blurb for a novel, Julianne. And of course, I mean, I want to just give the readers and my listeners a little bit of a background. You grew up in Colombia up until the age of 18. You were born in Colombia?
No, I was actually born in Cambridge, England, which okay. I'm sure is very evident from my accent.
Of course.
Yes. Well, my mother's English and my father's American. So me and all my siblings were born in England. But we all grew up in Colombia. So I lived in Cali until I was 18 years old. Because my parents were working for an international development organization called CIAT, C-I-A-T, important distinction, mm-hmm. not CIA. T is essential. So they've been based in Colombia since the early 70s. Wow. And so they lived there until around 2010, 2012. Like, they live in Portland, Oregon now.
Wow, but it's a nice place to have gone up to, Portland, Oregon. Very, very, mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of Portland, Oregon, but I'm also mm-hmm. a big fan of Cali, too. I mean, that's the first place I knew in Colombia from 1998 when I was flown out there by WWF to travel the Pacific Coast. Mm-hmm. A different Colombia, one that you definitely, deal with in your book. So you're, I mean, from let's say the ages of 0 to 18, you're in Cali and you're growing up there, you're growing up Colombian. I mean, this is an identity, obviously, but you're Anglo-American, but really Colombian. I mean, I can tell a little bit there, you know, it's that these are the formative mm-hmm. years of your life, up to 18 years. So you are at a private school in Cali. That was the upbringing.
Yeah, so my sister and I went to an American international school, which had both like American and I guess Colombian school curriculum.
Yeah.
And so, you know, growing up, like a lot of my friends were also from like different countries from around the world. Also like from Colombia, but like gradually as like my sister and I got older, we sort of became kind of like the only quote unquote gringos left like in our year. Yeah. Because everyone else's family had moved away at that point just because of the security situation.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's fascinating to be able to deal with, you know, let's say a 20-year period, two decades, of course, two incredibly fraught decades. And mm-hmm. that you deal with not only paramilitaries, guerrillas, but something that's very interesting to me, local elites. And I find that to mm-hmm. be such a pivotal segment of society here on every level. I mean, just today I was down at the butcher's buying some beef and I couldn't park the car anywhere because of all the escoltas. And then, yeah. you know, the guy at the butcher said, oh yeah, Pacho Santos is around the corner in his favorite cafe. And you're like, oh, again? And it's the local elites that permeate every level of society. And I'm not going to lie, my son goes to a very, well, I would say an exclusive nursery school here in Bogota. Mm-hmm. He's growing up with these local elites, much like I would assume that you experienced mm-hmm. at this American school. Although, yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, that was something I guess I was interested in, like, depicting in the book, like, something that was sort of reflective of my experience growing up there. Like, I didn't really want to write a book that was sort of, like, poverty porn or, like, violence porn. I wanted to, like, write a book. You know, I think that is, like, a valid depiction and, like, an important depiction, like, of Colombia, like, books that sort of, like, focus on the poverty and the violence. And I do believe that my book does that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have, like, some excellent novels, like Los Ejércitos, like, The Armies by Aurelio Rosero, which is, like, set in, like, this small rural town in Nariño that's, like, completely devastated by paramilitary violence. Like, that is a side to Colombia's story that is very important to reflect upon and, like, very important to depict.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as you were saying, another important thing to acknowledge are the sort of very deep class and social divisions within Colombia, which is what I grew up with. Like, my classmates, you know, were going to inherit sugarcane factories, you know, their father's companies, their father's businesses. You know, it was a very different world, you know, from what I think a lot of other Colombians inhabit. Mm-hmm. And so a big theme to me of the book, I suppose, like, the main plot of the book follows a group of young female friends from when they're around, like, 8 years old up until they're around, like, in their mid-20s. And we sort of see, like, what has happened to their friendship and, like, how they drift apart and how they grow up. And a big theme that comes out of that is, like, how do people sort of, like, realize that, wow, I just grew up in a really sheltered environment and I just don't really understand my own country. You know, like, what is, like, the true Colombia? Is it people who study abroad in, like, Spain and New York? Or is it people who never come down from the barrio, mm-hmm. right? And they just, like, stay there their whole lives, right?
Yeah.
So I really wanted to show that conflict. And you have, like, some stories where, or some chapters where that's evident. Like, there's one story, like the third one, M plus M, which is about a friendship between a very wealthy girl and a boy who comes to the school, like, on a scholarship, and sort of, like, what happens between them. So, yeah, so that was definitely an important theme that I wanted to show in the book, of just, like, how when you live in this very kind of privileged, sheltered world, it can, you know, be sort of, like, easy to ignore the realities of the country. But at the same time, like, the violence still does affect you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't want to write a book that was sort of, like, very hyperkinetically violent, like, you know, Rosario Tijeras or, you know, Fernando Vallejo's books, mm-hmm. which I really enjoy. But, you know, those books were sort of like sicarios and like narco contract killers and like girls in like really tight fitting clothing, like shooting guns. Like I wouldn't have felt like honest, mm-hmm. you know, that wasn't really like my story to tell. Like that wasn't, I mean, what I ended up writing, I suppose, was about people who were affected by violence, where you hear rumors about, you know, your classmates being kidnapped, you know, the electricity going out because of bombs going off. And then just also this sense of menace, of just this feeling that like anything could happen at any time, which is like what me and my friends grew up with, of just this sense that there was this terrible danger, like outside of our homes with like their big gates and like locked doors, and that any moment we could be seized by it, but we didn't know exactly what it was or right. what was causing it. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think more than sort of explicit scenes of violence, I think what I was more interested in this exploring was like this sense of menace, yeah. like this constant sense of tension.
I think that's an absolutely spot on example of Colombia, because we can exist, and especially when I'm not saying you particularly, but we can exist mm-hmm. here in Colombia without really even ever experiencing directly, let's say, some of this violence, but the aggression is always there. And I'm even yeah. saying it to this day, 2017, you know, I live in a nice, well-heeled barrio here in Bogota, and I, you know, I live a privileged lifestyle, but you know that there's something rippling beneath the surface, the superficiality of everything that's going on. Everything's great. It's sunny outside. You can walk to your cafe. But at any moment, you know, even today, after, let's say, in a post-accord situation, who knows exactly? Like, as I mentioned, that top-ranking politician who I prefer mm-hmm. not to know a lot about, you know, buying in the butcher shop near, you know, someone could be after him, you know, for yeah. something that he said. I didn't live too far from when the bomb was put on Fernando Londoño's mm-hmm. Car. We heard it from my apartment when I lived there, and you know, it's these things are always there. But of course, if you're growing up in Cali during these years, it's much more present than it is now. I mean, and Cali has a yeah. reputation a little bit for that, and unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think especially like in the 80s and the 90s, which is like when I was growing up there, you know, the situation was more unstable. I mean, my parents, in like the 35 years that they lived in Colombia, like they never purchased property. Like they rented their house for 35 years because they would say every year, like, well, what's the point? We're leaving next year. It's so dangerous. Everyone else we know is leaving, but they stayed for 35 years. So
your parents are the yeah. best tenants ever.
Yeah, they really were. Well, apparently the landlord was really anxious to have them move out because he wanted to sell the house to sort of condominium developers. So apparently my old childhood home is now this Baptist church. I was looking at it on Google Maps, and my brother said he went to go visit it, and that there's just like this giant gate down like the little dirt road that led to our home, and like a giant poster of like the Virgin Mary. And I'm like, well, you know, it's like in that Jack Nicholson movie, like About Schmidt, where he goes to see his old childhood home, and it's like this tire shop.
Yeah.
But in our case, it's like this like evangelical community center or whatever.
I think that makes it fantastic. I have a childhood home in Portugal, in fact, in the south, inland from Lule and these areas, which with a beautiful field that we owned in front of the building to protect it from being built on, with all the wildflowers growing out there, has been paved over for a car park now. I looked it up in a 40-year-old's in a spat of nostalgia on Google Maps as well. It's like, I should never have done that, you know? I should never have done that.
Well, it's very funny to me because I have a character in one of the chapters. I keep wanting to call them short stories because the book has been published in the UK as a short story collection, but in the States it's been published as a novel. But in one of the chapters, Honey Bunny, which mm-hmm. was the piece that was published in The New Yorker, mm-hmm. There's a scene where the girl looks up her school on Google Maps, I think. And so I find it sort of funny that, like, after I wrote the book, my life is now starting to, like, reflect what I wrote. So that's a bit strange. But, yeah, there's something sort of, like, poignant about that. And mm-hmm. I think that was maybe one of the themes of the book as well, just sort of, like, how kind of sad it is to sort of, like, grow up, you know, nostalgia, saudade, I think they say in Portugal. I probably butchered the pronunciation, but... But anyway, I think because I wrote the book in England, you know, so I didn't visit Colombia while I was writing the book. So I was relying purely like on my memories or sort of other nonfiction and fiction works I was reading at the time. I think that was like a question I was sort of starting having up in Colombia.
Well, you weren't writing it in Colombia.
Like, what is sort of like the purpose of nostalgia? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I think the book is maybe infused with, like, a lot of that. Like, somebody told me once, like, oh, it's filled with so many references to, like, the 90s and so many references to, like, films. And I guess that's just because when you're in middle school, that's maybe what's sort of, like, important to you. It's like, yeah, what bands I listen to, like, that's sort of, like, who defines me as a person. But I kind of like that in my book you have characters who, you know, they're arguing about Titanic and they're, like, making each other, like, CDs with, like, PJ Harvey or, like, The Clash, like, on the track listing. Because, again, it shows, like, a side to Colombia of, you know, again, of people just trying to, like, live their lives and just trying to get on with it, right? But then what's weird is that you have this sort of really intense contrast of, like, that versus people whose entire families have been murdered or they're, like, crippled from being, like, attacked by contract killers, right? Yeah. So
I
see a really
that,
intense contrast.
That contrast between the mundanity, mundaneness of life and, of course, then the savagery as well, so present in Colombia. This is fascinating. I'm really enjoying this so far. I'm really enjoying how we're chatting about this. We're going to take a short break, though, and come back and record the next section. This is episode 199 of Colombia Calling. We're talking to Julianne Pacheco, the author of The Lucky Ones. I feel very privileged to have her on because it's a book that's received, I mean, rave reviews. I mean, check out the Amazon reviews, check them out on Barnes and Noble. People are really raving about this new book. They're saying, you know, the launch of a new voice. I mean, that's very exciting. That's very flattering for anyone. So if you want to find out more about Julianne, check out her website. It's juliannepacheco.com. Very easy. But I'm going to go away right now for just a little minute, and we're going to come back and talk further about The Lucky Ones and Colombia in general with Julianne, because it's fascinating, this. And I think the theme of nostalgia is something that we should visit further. But don't go away. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall talking to Julianne Pacheco, the author of The Lucky Ones, out recently. You can get it, of course, this great book. You can get it in the UK. You can get it in the US. You can get it on Amazon. There's no excuse for you not to buy this book that Julianne has written about Colombia, set between 1993 and 2013. It's called The Lucky Ones, and it has had rave reviews. I'm going to read one now and embarrass Julianne up there in Medellin. Written by Marisa Silva, who's a New York Times bestselling author of The Little Nothing and Mary Coyne. And I just read this and I thought, wow, if any day I ever got a review of this nature, I think that's it. I'd retire on it. I'd rest on my laurels. But anyway, I'm going to read it now. It says, Julianne Pacheco takes a hammer and brings it down on the superficial gloss of history, piecing the fragments into a kaleidoscopic collage that tells a deeply observed, stylistically adventurous, and emotionally riveting story of people caught up in the violence of Colombia's guerrilla insurgencies, moving effortlessly between the surreal and the real, sometimes in the space of a single sentence. Pacheco delivers one of the most original and mesmerizing debuts I've read in years. So I hope you're blushing.
Yes.
I mean, to take that in your stride is something. But I want to talk about it because it's. I mean, you really do. I mean, and I saw that Silvana Paternoster, who wrote you know, My Colombian War and everything, which I have read. They've really written you up. I mean, they really announce you at, but they also announce you really. I would suggest as a Colombian author. But we've established you were born in Cambridge, and you're now living in not far from Cambridge, really. And you're doing your PhD in creative writing up there at UEA. I mean, very exciting stuff. I mean, so at the moment, you're focusing, I would assume, essentially on your PhD.
Yeah, well, I'm almost done with it. I'm submitting at the end of September.
Congratulations.
God willing. Thank you.
Inshallah, God winning, yes.
Yeah.
That's very exciting indeed. And your, let's say, your thesis, your dissertation is based on, what can I ask you about it?
Yeah, so I'm getting my PhD is in creative critical writing, which I think is sort of maybe like a new field. Like, I don't really know how many doctorate programs in it exist, but it's basically you write the bulk of your thesis is a creative project, so a novel, a short story collection. So I wrote The Lucky Ones as part of my PhD degree, and then what I'm finishing right now is a critical essay about violence in work by Garcia Marquez and Roberto Bolaño. So, so that's what I'm finishing now. And I did the PhD because I did the master's initially at the University of East Anglia, which is quite, I guess, like, well-known in England. I don't know so much about, like, outside of England. But I basically did it because I'd never really finished sort of a long piece of work before. I'd written sort of, like, 2,000, 3,000 word short stories, but I wanted to sort of give myself more time to like work on my writing and sort of show to myself that I took it seriously. And so the master's was like a really good opportunity for that, because I think that's something that's sort of becoming increasingly more popular, where people are like, oh, like, should I get like an MA or like an MFA in like creative writing? Like, how do I find time to work on my own creative projects, right? And I think some people are able to do it outside the academy. But I was sort of at a point in my life where I'd done so many different jobs and I didn't really know what to do. And I knew that I really loved reading and that I loved writing. And so I just decided like, well, I'll get a master's and see what happens. And then I stayed on to do the PhD. And like, then I hope to, I have like a part-time job teaching creative writing in Sheffield, at Sheffield Hallam University. So I'm hoping to stay sort of like in that field of like teaching creative writing, because I really enjoy it. I find it like really fulfilling.
That's very inspirational indeed. And in fact, I think you're my hero, because that's really why I moved into to try and do my doctorate, is to be able to focus on a larger project. I mean, I've got various projects, but they all sort of simmer away. and life gets in the way. So I think perhaps if you'd go into maybe a PhD, it gives you that time. Now I'm the past all of the taught section of it, which thank God. not to say I enjoyed it, but it was just it was so heavy on my life, you know. And did you take classes? Because I know, I mean, I'm from the UK, but I do know that UEA, University of East Anglia, is very highly regarded in this creative writing field. Did you take classes with one of my favorites, Ian McEwan?
No, so he doesn't teach there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Unfortunately. He was one of the first students, so that's why I guess he's sort of very famously like affiliated with the program.
Right.
But yeah, they've had quite a few successful people come out of that program, like Ishiguro, like the author of like The Remains of the Day.
Yeah.
But I guess what I sort of found valuable was just being around like other people who took writing very seriously. Yeah. I found that very motivating. And I don't know. I mean, right now I'm like working on my next book, like my next novel. And it's just sort of like really making me realize that I think so much of writing is just about being like really stubborn and just like, because I think it's so easy to have self-doubt and just think like, my idea is so stupid, my voice is stupid, like, why is anyone going to care about this? And I think so much about just pressing on to the end of just, like, finishing a project of just, it's just being really stubborn.
Yeah.
Like, really, like, bullheaded. Yeah, I just think it's, like, interesting. I feel like I'm meeting, like, so many people who say that, like, oh, I want to write, I want to be a writer, I want to, like, finish a project. And it seems to me, I don't know, I think it's, like, great that, like, people have this need to, like, express themselves, mm-hmm. or they want to be creative.
It is, definitely. Obviously, my father always used to say that everyone has a book inside them, but it's whether you can get it out or not. I mean, that's another thing. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that stubbornness of which you speak is, of course, has a lot to do with it. Is that the stubbornness that got you the editor and the agency who was I've looked at them. I mean, they're a pretty serious outfit.
I feel like really lucky to be working with my agency. I mean, the way it happened was, I had a tutor, James Scudamore at UEA, who had sort of a similar background to me, where he'd grown up in, like, Ecuador and, like, Brazil. And so his agent, like, Claire Alexander, she was married to, like, a man from Uruguay. So she'd spent time in, like, Latin America. And so that was very important to me, where I wanted to work with an agent who had a connection with Latin America, to sort of, like, understand, like, where I was coming from. And so I submitted one of the stories, like the first chapter in the book, which is called Lucky. I submitted it to this competition called the Sunday Times Short Story Award. And that was in 2013, I think. And I was long listed for the award. And so after that, I had emailed Claire. But then after I was long listed, like, she got in touch with me. And we kind of went from there. So I think the submitting to the competition definitely helped in terms of, it probably would have happened, like, eventually, but, that's why I think sort of, like, submitting to competitions, like, especially for short story writers, can be, like, a really helpful thing to do.
It gets you onto the page, doesn't it? It gets you on the, and of course they've serialized, well, as you say, Granta magazine published, is it Honey Bunny, the story and stuff. So that gets it out there
It was the New Yorker that published Honey Bunny, and Granta published another story.
All right, I'll get it right eventually.
So like, sound really pretentious to be like, get it right, Richard.
I'm permanently walking a tightrope of getting things wrong, so it's okay. It's okay.
Oh, no, I'm just being silly.
It's all right. Now, I am fascinated. I'm fascinated that you're doing your critical essay on violence in Gabo's works, because I edited it and contributed to a book a couple of years ago called Was Gabo an Irishman? Tales from Gabriel Garcia Marquez's homeland, Colombia. One of my stories, both of my stories, obviously deal with violence. One of them, of course, deals with the Nobody Writes to the Colonel. And the other one really deals to, I took as my inspiration, News of a Kidnapping. And it bases itself around the pamphlets that the paramilitaries were dropping in Mompox when I was opening up my little hotel, and they pamphleted us these horrible, horrible pamphlets of who they were going to kill and disappear and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And my father was alive at that time, and he'd worked in Colombia in the 1970s and actually gone through some serious issues, but we don't need to talk about those right now. But he wrote me an email, which I still have. He's passed away, but he wrote me an email saying, please promise me not to write about politics unless you want to end up headless in a ditch. I mean, that was his warning. So that you're writing about the violence, and you know, Garcia Marquez is not, as you say, like Vallejo in the whole explicit violence porn, but it's there. It's definitely there.
Yeah. I mean, the book that I guess I'm focusing on is Crónica de una muerte anunciada, Chronicle of a Death Foretold. Because I guess what I find interesting about that book is, like, you have this very powerful theme of, like, the community's accountability and impunity, right? And just, like, the sort of pointlessness and helplessness, like, of the act, right? And it was sort of interesting to read that was sort of Garcia Marquez's intention when writing the book, because he based it on, like, a real life incident that happened to, like, a childhood friend that he knew about. I don't want to like spoil the book for listeners, but it's definitely worth reading. It's a novella. It's very short.
And of course it was filmed in Mompos, the Italian filmmakers. They filmed it in Mompos.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And the house at which they planned the murder and sat around the table is still in the same state because it's a beautiful house that's been fallen into disrepair and is like a tenement building. There's like sort of 15 different families living in it in poverty. Mm. And so, that image of them sat at the table that was then cast into the movie is still in place today. Mm. Although the house has been sold, so. So it will change soon. So you've missed out.
I guess so.
But this is an issue of impunity is very interesting. And so is this an issue that you're picking up in your next piece of writing, Impunity in Colombia?
I think so, yeah. Just because, I don't know. I mean, the other book I was writing about was Bolaño's 2666, mm-hmm. which is sort of the opposite of Crónica in the way that it's a massive book. Mm-hmm. It's very violent. It sort of infamously has this very long chapter that's a sort of an inventory of women who've been murdered at the border in Juarez in the early 90s.
Yeah.
And so I guess both of those books have sort of affected mm-hmm. my next project. Because I guess that is sort of the thing where you don't want to live in a society where that can happen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like the other day, I saw this woman whose like face was really scarred and the person I was with told me that her boyfriend had thrown acid on her.
Right.
And it's like, I had heard about things like that happening.
Right.
But I guess that's going to be a theme in my next book of just like the violence against women here specifically is something that I like personally find very upsetting. So
there's a lady who was pretty much almost beaten to death by her partner here in mm-hmm. Bogota called Maisa Covaleda, and she has a Facebook group. I've been in touch with her about a potential interview in the future, but she's very, very active now, giving speeches and traveling around trying to draw awareness to this situation because it's something that's, I mean, the statistics are horrendous and these aren't complete statistics because we don't know what goes on out there behind closed doors. And of course, in rural Colombia, where this may be a little bit more, commonplace.
And I guess it's particularly upsetting because you see in the States, like so much talk going on of just these like men online who are just so hateful and are like bringing that hate out in real life. So like, again, it's not just about sort of like listing these incidents of like violence against women and saying that's so terrible, but to like also like look at the men and be like, well, what does it mean to be like a good man in society? Mm-hmm. Right. Like that to me also seems to be like a very important thing to like examine of like, well, why are the men behaving like this, you know? So those are all sort of like very broad topics, but
Well, one of the reviews that you got on Amazon, and again, I'm not going to embarrass you this time again, but they, aside from the some of them people saying it feels like a collection of short stories, well, that would make sense that it was released as short stories like in the UK. But one of the reviews I read was that your ability to express emotions is quite second to none. And so therefore, if you're dealing with this kind of issue, this terrible issue, violence against women, then you are perfectly positioned to write about it. Are you interviewing people who've been through this situation that you know could give you
that's
a
sort of what I've been trying to do in like Medellin. Like I don't want to give away.
Yeah, don't
too
give
much
away.
I don't really like to talk about.
Yeah, but we'll get you on progress. Once it's published. You know, we'll get you on again once it's published. Right?
Yeah, but it's also like my mother's work for most of her career. You know, she's a sociologist,
right.
So the focus of her research has been on like women farmers.
Huh.
So that's sort of like always been, I guess, like an influence in my life too, of just like this knowledge that my mother's been doing this work, and sort of like the people that she's met and that she's interacted with over the years. And I guess tied into it all too is just the current situation of the peace negotiations, yeah. Right? And sort of the question of like, well, where is Colombia going to go from here? How do you heal as a country? How do you live with scars? How do you move on? What does that look like on an individual level for people who might still be like living in like very violent situations? Yeah, I mean, I really didn't want to write about Colombia again. Like, after finishing The Lucky Ones, I was just like, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to write about something else. But I think with the peace negotiations and, like, the fact that, like, the referendum was, like, voted no, I just felt compelled to... I'll write one more book about Colombia, and then I'll move on.
No, see, I've heard this before. You may be aware of the author Tom Feiling, who wrote Short Walks from Bogota. He wrote The Candy Machine about how the cocaine industry. And then I had him on the show many months ago, and I know he's in Colombia at the moment, but I had him on the show many months ago talking about his new book about Providencia or Providence. And he said, I wanted to write a book about where I'm from. And of course, it's a book based around the English history of Providencia, but it's still a Colombian island. I mean, he couldn't cut that link to Colombia in the end. I mean, I've heard this before. I think you'll keep writing about Colombia, or it will some way continue to influence you in the future. I think we can say
we'll
that safely.
We're winding down
the show. It's been really interesting talking to you and hearing your insights and stuff. I want to ask one question, is that, you know, writers are always told to sort of base stories or their work on, you know, let's say, things that have happened to them or things that they know or have experienced. And I imagine that when you're writing in The Lucky Ones, and we'll go back to The Lucky Ones, that's a nice way of tying it back, and you talk about the local elites and you talk about the students and stuff, I imagine you base, you know, kind of an amalgamation of these characters on people that you grew up with. I mean, the students. And have any of your like former friends come forward and said, that's clearly me?
No, thank God, because I was very careful not to do that.
Yeah.
That's not something I was interested in doing. I mean, I did do things where it's like I would take a detail, like describe the way a certain area in my childhood home looks.
Yeah.
And then, of course, my mother reads that part, and then she thinks that everything else that happens in the story is true. And it's like, no, that's not how fiction works. Just because there's one detail that is inspired by real life, like the rest of it, you know, doesn't necessarily mean it would have happened, right? No, that wasn't something. I hope I was careful not to do that, because again, that's what's fun about fiction, where like fiction gives you the liberty to explore and like write about things that didn't really happen, you know. Like if someone came up to me and was like, it wasn't really like this in our high school, I would say, no, I know it wasn't.
Uh-huh.
It's fiction, I made it up, it's not true.
Okay. You have a broad safety net of fiction there.
Exactly. But I do you know, like I journal a lot, and so I do use real life details like from my childhood as a basis for my fiction. I mean, something else I found very helpful for The Lucky Ones was reading a lot of nonfiction books. So, you know, you mentioned the Colombian author like Silvana Paternostro, who like reviewed my book. Like her book, My Colombian War, was a huge influence on me.
Mm.
So that was something else I found like very helpful to read, like other people's sort of like memoirs, like Hector Abad's, like El Olvido Que Seremos, Oblivion. That was also really helpful because, again, I've always thought of myself more of a reader than a writer. Like, I think if I had to choose between reading or writing, I would definitely choose reading. I find reading so much more fulfilling, so much more enjoyable. I mean, writing is fun too, but if I had like a knife to my throat, it would be reading like all the way. So I find, I guess like more so than real life inspirations, I find reading other books, like other works of fiction, are like what really helps me. Yeah.
Well, fantastic. I think it's excellent. And again, that safety net of fiction protects you all the way through. And it's true. But, well, you're in the correct field then if you want to read a lot, especially if you're teaching up at Sheffield Hallam. I mean, you get to read a lot of homework in creative writing. Let me just take this moment to say thank you so much for being on the show. It's a real pleasure to have you on here. It's an inspiration, I know, not only to me, but to others out there listening, and I recommend that people go out there and you know, just get a copy of this book, The Lucky Ones. Have a read of it. If you don't want to read it as a novel, read it as a selection of short stories. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's two for one. Yeah. It's a deal.
There you go. It's two for one. So, and you can check out Julianne on her website, is juliannepacheco.com. Very easy, very nice website, very clear. It's not covered with all sorts of flash and all other stuff. So please, you know, support the people that we're trying to promote here on Columbia Calling, and to understand a bit more about Columbia, because I think that's the base, what we try to do here on this podcast, a little bit more about what is Columbia, and that final thing you really said is, where is Columbia going, this next era for Columbia. You know, it really is a very it's not only worrying, but it's also a very exciting time here. You know, both sides can play off against one another. And I'm continually brought back to the idea of the 2018 presidential elections, which have me completely flummoxed as to what might happen. And so, I mean,
we'll have to see.
You will have to see. You'll be back in September next year. So you'll be back for just before, I guess, or just after.
Yep.
It'll be very interesting. And, well, you know, stay in touch. Let us know what you're up to, and once your new book's coming out, and we'll have you on the show again if you'll be on the show. It's because it's
of
been a
course. Thank you so much for having me.
You're most
it's been
welcome.
Real fun.
You'll be most welcome. And so I'm just going to sign off now quickly. This has been episode 199. I'm Richard McCall for Columbia Calling. We've been talking to the author Julianne Pacheco, and it's been an excellent podcast. So thank you all for listening, and of course tune in next week when we'll have another interesting person on the line or here in person talking about something Columbia related. Thank you for listening. Bye bye.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.